marriage is about doing the right thing. It's about doing what's good. It's about doing what's responsible. It's about doing what's faithful to keep my promise. It's about obeying my God. That's the bottom line of what marriage is all about.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. Today on Christianity at Work, Dr. Jack Crabtree and professional counselor Christine Barber continue their discussion about the foundations of marriage. Everyone struggles in marriage, and having a clear understanding of what marriage is for can have a profound effect on how people handle their struggles. Let's listen to Jack and Christine.
I think a lot of times we define love as feeling good. I think we particularly do that in marriage. That when I get married, if I'm feeling good about my spouse, then I'm in love. If I'm not feeling good, then I'm not in love. I'm out of love. What do you think about the whole concept of love as feeling good?
Okay. Well, the love that should be, that the love that is the essence of what a marriage commitment is, has nothing to do with how we feel, or very little to do with how we feel. There is a phenomenon in human experience that has everything to do with feelings, and we do call that love. But that love is not what makes a marriage go. And that's part of the mythology of our culture, is that there will be this person out there that makes me feel tender and caring and noble and giving and serving, and because I have all those kinds of feelings that are elicited out of me, that if I can just marry that person, then being kind and selfless will be the most natural thing in the world, and that will last forever, and that'll be eternal.
Well, the interesting thing is, Jack, is that when we first get to know somebody, when we're courting somebody, when we're dating somebody, we really do feel very noble.
Yes.
All those natural feelings of the feeling good stuff really does kind of bubble up in us, and I think we come to think, oh, well, I feel it now, it's going to last forever.
Exactly. But the problem is that universal human experience is that feeling does not last forever. It goes away. I'm inclined to think that love is a kind of God-given organic drug that sort of gives us this vision. You know, it builds right into my feelings a vision for what a commitment to another person could be all about. But God never intended that feeling to persist. What he wants to take its place, and what must take its place, what has to if our marriage is going to survive, is a moral commitment, a taking on of the task, the responsibility, the duty to become one with that other person in the way that my feelings can only kind of give me a vision of. But the actual becoming one with my spouse is going to be work, in a sense. It's going to be something that I have to make an effort to do, and I have to make a commitment to. That's love in another sense. That's the love that's going to make a marriage happen.
We'll get back to our discussion on the foundations of marriage in just a few moments. First, here's some information about Jack and Christine so you can become better acquainted with them. Christine Barber has spent the last 20 years as a family counselor. Each day, she works with people who need to see the truth of God's Word applied to everyday life. Christine believes that understanding how the Bible describes human existence is vitally important to making sense of our experiences. Jack Crabtree is a professional philosopher, theologian, and teacher. For several years, he was on the pastoral staff of Peninsula Bible Church in Palo Alto, California. He has been teaching at Mackenzie Study Center, as well as the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, Willamette University, and Gutenberg College for the past 15 years. And he's one of the pastors at Reformation Fellowship in Eugene. Jack's passion is first to understand the biblical text, then to apply that text and its principles in a consistent way to everyday life. Well, enough information for now regarding Jack and Christine. Let's get back to their discussion regarding the biblical foundations of marriage.
The love that makes a marriage happen, you're saying, is a commitment toward oneness with another person.
Right.
A commitment toward understanding and valuing and caring about who another person is.
Right. Rather than this feeling that our mythology tells us is true love. I mean, if you listen to our music, look at our literature, look at our movies, listen to the lyrics of the music that we listen to day in and day out, they're full of people longing for that love that will never die. You know, what do we call it? True love, everlasting love, real love. And what we mean by that is, you know, for the last 6 relationships, I've fallen in love with somebody, and I thought it was true love, but you know what? It wasn't really true love because after a while, it died. It went away.
I don't feel that high anymore.
I don't feel it, yeah.
So I've got to go out and look for the 7th relationship that will give me that high of feeling really good and the feeling really good that is sustained.
Yeah, it won't. This time it won't go away.
Mm-hmm. Or I've got to find one. I've got to keep dropping them until I find one that doesn't go away.
Right. Because our mythology says that person is out there, and if I just find that person, then I will live happily ever after. But alas, poor me, I've been tricked into thinking that these other relationships were that true love until the love died.
I've just been a bad chooser. I've just got to become a better chooser, find the guy that is going to always love me, always make me feel good.
Exactly. All of that is mythology. All of that is illusion. It's a mythology that's just deeply ingrained in our culture, and it's something that our imaginations, our hearts really respond to. We would love for that to be reality. But of all people, we as Christians need to be soberly realistic about that. Life doesn't work that way. There is no such thing as true love in that sense.
I can imagine myself years ago hearing you say this and kind of having a tantrum, wanting to put my fist up against the wall and say, no, you're wrong, that's not true. And what comes to mind is one of my favorite movies at the time was Camelot. And boy, talk about a mythology, and this kind of mythology of I really should look for a true love that sustains me, that makes me feel good all the time, and that's really what marriage should look like. It's in that movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's in that movie. It's in all the Walt Disney movies that we've ever seen from the beginning of time. It was in most of the sitcoms that we watched, even way back into the 50s. Yeah, it's just deep, deep, deep in our culture. And our expectations have all been fed on that mythology. So much so that in Camelot or in something like Dr. Zhivago, the movie Dr. Zhivago, those movies manipulate us into applauding the adulterous relationship over the decent, solid, mundane marriage relationship.
Yeah, as you're talking, I think I as a kid or as a young adult, put Dr. Zhivago on a really high pedestal with his mistress and really liked that and really wanted that and would have put his wife kind of in a place below. Mm-hmm. In my mind, she's below, and same with Camelot. King Arthur is kind of lower than, he's less than, he's not as good as the beauty and the joy and the delight of Lancelot.
Yeah, they're mistakes. They were the people that they married before they found their true love, and too bad they didn't find their true love first and could be married to them. That's our way of thinking about it.
Yeah, they goofed. They should have gone toward what was beautiful and wonderful and joyful.
And what we as Christians have done is only rejected that halfway and too often. We realize that the adulterous relationship, that's not biblical. There's something really wrong with that. But we don't really discard the whole illusion altogether. We think that what I should do is make my marriage into that kind of relationship that Zhivago has with his mistress, or
Guinevere had with Lancelot.
Yeah, exactly. And so we might read books and go to seminars to try to teach us how to bring love into my marriage and how to make my marriage romantic, as if that's really what the substance of marriage should be all about.
As if that's the goal. Now, is that a wrong thing to have, to feel good or to have romance or to have good feelings in my marriage?
Well, in the sense in which I'm thinking of it, yes, because it is so totally unrealistic. It's not wrong to have feelings of genuine affection and tenderness and profound and deep joy in the presence of my spouse. In fact, that would be to be desired and to be expected in a healthy marriage relationship. But they're not going to be these glittering, glamorous, intoxicating kind of romance that the movies are portraying. We have to make a distinction between them. I mean, that kind of feeling that we have had in our life experience, where we are infatuated, completely infatuated with another person, and it was painful to be apart from them, and we couldn't get enough of them, we couldn't be in their presence too much, and everything they did was just absolutely amazing, and everything I did was calculated to serve them and to meet their needs and so on, or at least that was my perception. That's a very rare and unusual feeling to have toward another person, and it cannot in real life ever be sustained.
Yeah, but when we see these movies, we don't see the end of the show.
Absolutely.
What exactly. We see is that they just got into this great relationship, Guinevere with Lancelot, and it ends there.
Yeah.
What we're left to believe is, well, that's what continues on and on. They found it, they've got it, they get to leave the old bugger of a husband and wife, and they get to be with this wonderful person forever and ever.
Right. Exactly. And that feeds the illusion of our culture.
You're saying it's a hurtful illusion. If I go into marriage thinking that what I really need to do is sustain this high of feeling, then I have really done myself a disservice.
Yeah, I've set myself up for complete defeat and disappointment.
Because what should I expect in marriage? Should I expect it to be dull? Should I expect it to be awful? What are you saying? We're saying what it's not. What is it?
Well, we should expect it to be ordinary. And what I mean by that is not, no, it's not boring, it's not dull, it's not, doesn't have to be awful. It can be very, very rewarding and very satisfyingly joyful. It can be all of that. But it's a much more muted, quiet, deeper emotion than the surface excitement and surface glitter of romance that our mythology tells us we should look for. But that profound joy that we can experience and that profound reward that we can experience in marriage also doesn't come naturally the way love comes when we are infatuated. We earn it. We earn the joy. And how do we earn the joy? By taking upon myself to do right by my wife or do right by my husband, to keep my vow to them, to keep my promise to them. And I think in a past conversation we talked about, for example, I make it a commitment to set my own values and my own interests and my own agenda aside and make room in my life for my wife's interests and my wife's values and my wife's agenda. I make that my own. I become one with her to that extent. Well, that doesn't come naturally to me. I'm not naturally interested in what she's interested in. But by making myself interested in what she's interested in, I form a kind of connection and a bond between us that ultimately is exceedingly rewarding. But I don't fall into it like tripping over a log. It just doesn't come naturally.
And I think that's what we really think. It's like tripping over a log, because when I initially meet someone, perhaps my future spouse, it does feel wonderful. I have tripped over this log and found this wonderful person.
Exactly.
So I think that I should be able to trip over a log and to think of it as really hard, ordinary, get your feet dirty kind of work.
Do the right thing.
That's a pretty foreign thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're saying that the work of marriage is really trying to become a person who's interested in values and cares about another person's interests and values, become interested and see who they are, to kind of know them, not kind of, but to really know them and to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
You also said it's to kind of set myself aside. And I know in a previous conversation we've talked about that, but can you bring a little bit of balance? Because I think people could think what you're saying is, I leave myself aside to become married and I only look at the other person. For example, I'm a counselor. Do I drop my interest in psychology? if my husband is totally disinterested?
No, not necessarily. I mean, not to the extent that it doesn't interfere with becoming one with my wife or husband. I don't have to drop anything. I don't have to drop any of my interests. Fundamentally, the issue is, what is it really that makes me a fulfilled human being? And I think the answer to that in biblical terms is that fundamentally I was made to be a loving being in the way that my God, my Creator, my Father is a loving God. And there's all kinds of interests that I might have that I could easily give up without throwing away my individuality and without throwing away my humanity. But I must never throw away my ability to sacrifice, to serve another person, to love another person, because to do that would be truly to throw myself away. Marriage is not about me denying the things that I want, the passions that I have, the interests that I have, and so on. I'm not making a commitment that I'm just not going to be me. I'm not going to feel what I feel. I'm not going to like what I like. I'm not going to desire what I desire. But I can consciously put my wife on a higher order of priority than anything else that I might have an interest for. And that's what the commitment is all about, to be willing to not pursue things that I am genuinely interested for the sake of my wife. I think it probably is the case, you would know better than I, about that there are perhaps relationships where people feel like their spouse is expecting them to just simply erase who they are. I mean, to not feel what they feel, to not be interested in what they're interested in, and so on. There's nothing in the marriage commitment that requires us to do that. I need to, out of a kind of moral strength, take an interest that really is there and say, you know what, I'm not going to pursue it, because what I want more than anything in the world is to become one with you, and that is going to interfere with that, so I will set that aside. But I don't do that out of weakness. I don't do that out of self-destruction and self-erasing. I do that voluntarily because I have a higher priority in my relationship with my wife. That's a whole different thing.
You're not saying I necessarily have to do that.
No,
may be required.
But that may be something that I choose to do, right? Yeah, no, it's never required, I don't think, necessarily. This is shifting gears a little bit, but can I come back to this whole notion of oneness that we've been talking about? Fundamentally, marriage is a kind of ordinary, and the word I use is moral commitment, and maybe you could help me unpack that. But what I'm getting at is I have taken upon a responsibility or a duty or a task that I feel morally obligated to appreciate the life experience of my wife as if it were my own. That's, I think, what the idea of becoming one means. But notice that I'm describing it as a commitment that I'm taking on, not some kind of spooky metaphysical entity that has been created. All too often in Christian culture, we talk as if two people get married and somebody somewhere with a magic wand waved a magic wand and all of a sudden created a new metaphysical entity that exists now. That, I don't think, is what Genesis is talking about. It's not that God or anyone else has created a new thing when we became married. We are still two individual human beings with our own individual creatureliness. But what has become different is I have declared my intention and made a promise and made a vow to that woman that I am going to relate to her in a particular way. And I'm morally bound to do so now.
Okay, so you're saying marriage is not something magical. Oneness is not something magical or tingly or what it is. It's hard work where the rubber meets the road, where I have to make one decision after another about whether I'm going to be selfish and only pursue my own interests, or whether I'm also going to include you in the scope of my life.
Exactly. And why would I do it? Because it's the right thing. Because it's the good thing. And because I made a promise to do so, and I need to keep my promise.
It's because I made a promise to my spouse to be committed to them, and I made a commitment to God to be committed to him.
Right.
And my commitment to God shows up in my commitment and my marriage.
Precisely, exactly.
Okay, now I want to go back to oneness too and talk a little bit about it from a different perspective. One of the things we said oneness is about a little bit today and in past conversations is that it's about looking at, understanding, appreciating, joining in another person's interests, who another person is, what they're about. Truly taking on myself the responsibility to do that. Another part of oneness, something that's really come home to me this week, is to, in a sense, in a very hard sense, rise up above my own stubbornness and my own sinfulness and my own hurt. This week, I got really angry at my husband. Some things occurred that I was really upset about. And I wanted, it didn't feel good. I wanted just to reject him. I wanted just to hurt him back. And I kept thinking that my commitment isn't that he would make me feel good, but my commitment was try to understand him, to try and forgive him, to try and enter back into what was very difficult for me to do. I'd rather be stubborn. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be selfish. I'd rather just see him as the problem. I'd rather just self-pity and sit in my room and hurt. So I think a huge commitment to oneness means not sitting back on my laurels and saying, well, this hurts, so I'm not going to try. I'm not going to look. I'm not going to enter into conversation again. It means that I have to enter into conversation again, even when it feels bad.
Right. And the commitment, of course, before God, we have a commitment to be merciful and forgiving to any human being. And that's certainly true in marriage, but not unique to marriage. But what's unique to marriage is I don't really have the option of just forgiving and letting them go their own way. My commitment is to forgive and, as you say, enter into the process of trying to understand them, trying to appreciate where they're coming from, see life through their eyes and all that means to become one.
And lots of times seeing life through their eyes will mean me having to look at their perception of me, which may be different than my perception of myself, whether or not they're right. Mm-hmm. I need to look at their perception of me and be open to the possibility that I was, in fact, a great part of what the problem was.
Right.
That's the process that's so much more difficult in marriage, because you're right. In a friendship, I can just take off. I can say, well, you know, it didn't work out. I'll be merciful. I'll be kind. I'll be polite. But in marriage, I need to enter into the very nitty-gritty of what is very difficult for me and to continue to do it and to do it over and over and over and over again. And what I find that does in my life is I end up being humbled. I end up finding a lot of struggle, a lot of suffering. It's just very hard to face into myself. And that's what ends up happening all the time in my marriage. This commitment to oneness means I have to face into myself. And what I often find is not a very pretty picture.
Yeah. I think, you know, back in the 60s, where the so-called sexual revolution, one of the things that they were rebelling against were the marriages of the 50s that they described as kind of hollow, empty shells and so on. And undoubtedly that was true. Many of them had experienced families where the husband and wife lived under the same roof, lived in the same institution of marriage, but lived very, very desperately isolated lives from one another. I think that comes about because people have not taken on the task that you just described, that they have treated one another as friends that they used, you know, as people that were formerly friends that they've walked away from. They've kept the outward appearance of being still married, of still being part of the same family, but they've emotionally and psychologically distanced themselves from one another and have gone their own way. And that's precisely what we're promising not to do when we become married and take the marriage vows, as I think the Bible understands marriage to be. We are committing ourselves, we are promising ourselves that we won't walk away in that way. We won't allow ourselves to become emotionally and psychologically distant. We won't allow ourselves to become isolated, because that's a violation of becoming one with somebody.
I think you're so, that's so right. And I think that what we, though, end up doing is having this glittering image that other people see as good and we maybe even come to think is good. We give up the other parts that are more important, that sink deeper, and we become the glittering image that looks good and other people applaud us from the outside.
As marriages, you mean?
Right.
We make ourselves look like a model marriage. And
that's right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Jack, what about the whole idea of our loyalty in marriage? You were talking about that with me before we started today. What were you talking about there?
Well, I think in a past conversation I mentioned that in the only thing that looks anywhere like a definition of marriage in the Bible, there seem to be two aspects to it. In Genesis it says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. We've talked a significant amount about the two shall become one flesh, but the other aspect of it is a man leaving his father and mother and cleaving to his wife. And it seems to me that's what is being described there is a certain level of loyalty that a man and woman are promising to one another. The Genesis text is written from the standpoint of what a man does, but I see no reason why the intention is not for that to be a completely mutual, reciprocal commitment. A man is promising to leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and a woman is promising to leave father and mother and cleaving to her husband. I think that's exactly symmetrical. The significance, I think, about leaving father and mother is that in the time and place and culture in which that text was written, there probably would have been no greater or higher human loyalty than a son or daughter's loyalty to their parents, particularly a son's loyalty to his parents, that he had known no greater loyalty. In our day and age, where family is kind of breaking down and deteriorating, we don't really fully appreciate what that kind of familiar loyalty would be like. But in that day and age, that would have been a really strong bond and strong loyalty. So it's remarkable that the biblical text says, you know that loyalty that you have to your parents? Your loyalty to your wife should surpass that. You should forsake your father and mother and cleave to your wife.
I think
that was a revolutionary thing for the text to say there.
Perhaps a parallel today, maybe not quite as strong, would be you need to leave your position as CEO as the most important position in your life and take on your marriage as more important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or if people have strong friendships, to think of it in terms of forsaking your friends and being loyal to this man or woman above your friends. Yeah, it's something we'd find it unthinkable to be disloyal to someone, another human being, and then say, no, you need to forsake that loyalty because your loyalty to your husband or wife is greater than that one. Now, of course, in a biblical perspective, there is a higher loyalty than my loyalty to my husband or wife. That's my loyalty to God, but that's not a human loyalty. I mean, that's a loyalty that's non-negotiable. There is no other human loyalty that should have any greater demand upon me than my loyalty to my spouse. Again, it seems to me that that's the commitment that we're making. That's the promise we're making. That's the thing we are morally binding ourselves to, that I'm going to make my decisions, go through my day by day through life, and not let any loyalty creep up there and become greater than the loyalty to my husband or wife.
So let me be a little bit of a devil's advocate. What if my husband really isn't loyal to me, really isn't interested in me, and I have a friend that's very interested, perhaps a girlfriend, someone of the same sex, someone I'm not at all romantically interested in? What would you say then?
Well, it's difficult to answer that without bringing up a kind of scenario where the loyalties come into conflict. For much of our lives, I can have a good friend who meets many needs that perhaps my husband or wife should meet, but they are neglecting to do so, and a friend meets those needs instead. That's not necessarily wrong or problematic. When my loyalty to my friend takes precedence over or eclipses my loyalty to my spouse, then I have transgressed my promise to my spouse. And we'd have to talk about a specific instance or a specific example of how that might happen. A good friend will not expect of me or demand of me that I be loyal to them above and beyond my spouse. They will actually, their friendship will consist of encouraging me to be loyal to my spouse, to encourage me to support them, to encourage me to keep my promise to my spouse.
Well, I guess what I keep thinking of is a person who's very, very involved in their job, for example. They're really busy with it. They work 60, 70, whatever hours a week. They think it, talk it, smell it. They're doing it all the time. And I have a friend that's interested in some of what I'm doing. They've got some time. They want to involve themselves in swimming lessons with our kids. They want to be a part of my life in a way that's realistic. And my husband's just not at all interested. And so I'm kind of pushing this point. Of course, this person is going to become very interesting and very much a part of my life because I'm alone. I'm basically, my spouse basically isn't married to me in a practical way.
Okay. There are two ways that my marriage vow comes to play here. One is it would be very easy and very natural for me to just give up on my spouse and say, he's not giving me what I need. This friend is more important to me. I'm just going to go get my emotional needs met by this friend. That, it seems to me, would be to be copying out on my marriage vow. Because my marriage vow was not about me having my husband meet my needs. My marriage vow was about me making a commitment to my husband. Whether he meets my needs or not, I stand before God on what I promised him. And the other way around. The husband stands before God with respect to what he promised his wife. It's not about the other person meeting my needs. It's about me keeping my promise. So if I decide to abandon the relationship emotionally and psychologically because he's not meeting my needs, then I'm copying out on my vows. So that would be problematic. The other thing that would be problematic is, say a situation comes up where my husband says, I'm doing such and such, I want you to go with me. My friend had plans for us to do something else, and I frankly want to be with my friend rather than my husband because it's going to be more fun. Very, very conceivably, that's a temptation to break my promise to my husband. Here my husband is making an overture in the direction of everything that my marriage is supposed to be all about. My promise, it seems to me, should take me in the direction of saying to my friend, my greater loyalty is to my husband. I've got to go with him. Now, without spelling out the scenario, it's difficult to... We shouldn't generalize to every situation, but it's when my relationship to my friend comes into conflict with my relationship with my husband somehow, and I'm forced to make a choice. My marriage vow doesn't give me any choice. My marriage vow says your priority is your husband or your wife.
So what we're talking about again is it might feel better to go with my friend. I really prefer being with my friend because I just like the fact that she understands me, she pays attention to me. My husband may not be as enjoyable to me, but my commitment is not to do what feels good, but to do what I've committed myself to do.
Exactly. That's the bottom line, and that's what we have to understand, that marriage is about doing the right thing. It's about doing what's good. It's about doing what's responsible. It's about doing what's faithful to keep my promise. It's about obeying my God. That's the bottom line of what marriage is all about. And we have to get into that frame of mind or we're just not going to be able to do this right. If I ever allow myself to get into the frame of mind, marriage is about getting my husband to meet my needs or marriage is about getting my wife to meet my needs, I've already lost. It's not going to work.
I wanted to add a little bit to this scenario. And what I'm thinking, Jack, is that if my husband in this scenario is leaving and going off to work 70, 80 hours a week, it could be just because my husband is a very selfish person. My husband has come just to look at his own needs. My husband perhaps just really likes the money, the power, the prestige, the job, the kudos, whatever it is. It could just be that. But I think if that's happening, I need to also ask myself another question. And if someone came into counseling telling me this, I would ask them this question. I wouldn't know the answer, but I would want to explore it with them, and I would certainly want them at least to explore it in themselves. The question would be, is there any way in which you are contributing to him wanting to leave?
Is he running from something
that truly is not good? Mm-hmm. Now, lots of times when I say that, especially in my teaching or in some public situation, oftentimes women will flare up and say, well, then you're blaming the wife. And in a sense, I am. I think I'm if it's blame, I'm blaming both of them. I think that marriage is really a dance and that we're responding to each other. We are dancing together. When I see that my husband leaves, he's leaving in the context of something. He could just be leaving in the context, as I said before, of his own desires and needs for prestige or power or comfort or whatever it is. But even then, I might need to look at myself and say, am I not giving him something that would be appropriate and right for me to give him, such that he is starving and needs to get it out there? At least that question has to be looked at seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I too often don't want to look at that question. I want to just blame him, be the victim, be the person who's at home suffering without having to look at my part. And again, I think that oneness has a lot to do with what role am I playing in contributing to what's good in this marriage and contributing to what's not okay here.
And the thing that, as Christians, that we have to keep in mind is, undoubtedly, at least part of the answer is, yes, I am contributing to hurt and pain and suffering in another person's life, because if the Bible is clear about anything at all, it is that we are naturally and inherently evil, sinful, selfish people. And we never do it right. We never do it completely right. So it would be absolutely crazy to not ask ourselves that question in view of what the Bible teaches us. We can come to understand in practical, concrete terms what it means for me to be a sinner by looking at the ways in which I'm hurting my spouse. That's a very, very important thing to learn.
Maybe the toughest thing to learn, though.
Yeah, and the thing that we least want to learn. That's why what you're saying, I think, is so important, is because there's a lot of things in life we don't mind learning, but learning about the nature of my own sinfulness is something that we really are allergic to.
We really don't want to see.
Yeah.
It really hurts to see it. It's really painful to see it. It usually often includes a lot of suffering. It includes looking at a reality of myself that I had much rather be blind to.
And many of us spent a lot of energy running from that knowledge. Hiding it from ourselves, denying it to ourselves, and so on. So
many of us? I think all of us.
Yeah.
We all of us run and hide from the reality of what's inside ourselves, and what's inside me is not good. I mean, again, if the Bible's correct, and you and I are both committed to believing that, I'm a sinner. And I don't want to look at the fact that I'm a sinner. I mean, I can say that theoretically, but to really look at it and see it, for me to look at and see myself this morning when I was talking to my husband, when I didn't want to, when I didn't want to see myself, is really tough. I'd rather just blame him. I'd just rather see him as the problem. And making the decision not to do that is like stopping a train going downhill without brakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ever experienced that?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to talk about this more in the future, but part of what the New Testament calls our sanctification, however, is the very process of learning to do what you described you're having experienced this morning. I mean, it's almost miraculous. Well, not almost. It is miraculous that any of us ever really do stop and say, now, wait a minute, maybe I'm a sinner and maybe I have something that I'm contributing here. But part of what it means to be a child of God is that for the first time in our lives, we begin to take that seriously, to take that on, and to begin to look at ourselves and begin to come to some kind of self-understanding of what it means for me to be a sinner. There are people in the world that the New Testament calls children of the devil who never get it, who will never look at it, and who will spend the rest of their days running from the reality of their own sinfulness. But we cannot make a bona fide claim to be a child of God if we can never, ever make any room in our lives for for taking a good hard look at ourselves and confessing with understanding, I am a sinner.
It's, and let's look back on it again in our marriage. I think what makes it hard is not only that I have to look at and see myself, but what makes it hard is also I'm vulnerable to another person. If I say where I'm wrong, then that person has some perhaps ammunition to use against me. At the very least, I'm vulnerable to that. Perhaps I have a spouse that really is not going to hurt me with the information that they get. And perhaps I've even experienced that over and over again. But somehow that's hard for us to get.
Mm-hmm.
Vulnerability is a very difficult thing for us. Opening ourselves up to the possibility of being hurt, rejected, left, in some way, is just a really hard thing to face into. So it's really it comes from both sides. It's a double whammy, and it makes marriage a very, very difficult. If we're doing marriage right, if we're really doing, heading toward oneness, it makes it a very difficult task because we're coming against the very essence of what we're most afraid to see and what we're most afraid to feel.
Yeah. And that's why trust is so important in the context of a marriage. I have promised to my wife that I'm not going to use the knowledge that I gain of her against her as ammunition against her. Part of becoming one is I'm going to appreciate life through your eyes. I'm not going to scorn it. I'm not going to disdain it. I'm not going to reject it. I'm going to learn to value it and appreciate it. That's what I promised. But can she trust me to keep my promise? That's ultimately the issue. And that trust is won over a lifetime of not abusing that trust.
But I think that it's unfair to say only if I can trust my husband I should be willing to go through this process of understanding and looking. No. That could be a cop-out not to do it. I still need to look. I might need to be discerning about how much I show, because I might be abused. He may be a person that I truly can't trust, and there's nothing noble about making myself vulnerable to someone who really is going to be hurtfully abusive toward me. But at the very least, I need to be willing to look at it myself. And right. To the extent where it's safe and wise, I need to share that with my spouse.
Yes, right. And we always have to keep in mind of what the ideal for the relationship is. The ideal for the relationship that I need to work toward, and that hopefully my husband or wife will work toward as well, is a relationship of complete trust and complete openness, because we are keeping our promise to become one in the way that we've been describing.
And, you know, that's probably the best thing there is in life, is when I'm in my relationship and I feel the opportunity to open up and to be vulnerable, where there is trust, I find so much comfort in that. I find so much good in that. I don't know of any other human experience that one can have, certainly that I've had, that's better than that.
And the betrayal of that is one of the most painful things that we experience in human life. That's why when we begin to talk in later conversations about the ethics of sexuality and stuff, that's why the Bible teaches us the sexual ethics that it does, is because to lie to someone, to deceive someone, to cheat someone out of that profoundly rewarding experience is one of the most heartless things a person can do.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're talking about something that is buried so deep in the human psyche. The promise, the security of that, the reward of that kind of trusting relationship and that kind of connection to a human being, another human being, we really, really want that. That's built deep in our human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts when we don't get it.
Mm-hmm. But most of us don't even know that it's out there to be gotten. And I think that's why we go toward the Lancelot type of relationship, where things are euphoric, because we really have exchanged something that, which is very lightweight. The euphoric, help me out, beginning of relationship, romantic.
The kind of surface intoxication.
Yeah, we think that's really what the best thing is. And lots of us, that's all we've ever tasted.
Mm-hmm.
It takes years and years of hard, laborious work where I'm facing into myself and looking at myself, and hard work at listening to and understanding you that I finally catch glimpses of and maybe move into the very heart and soul of what we're talking about here, which is far better and far more substantive than what I had in the beginning. But it tastes very different. I can't taste it through the euphoric, intoxicating romance. I don't even have a glimpse of it there. What I want, what I need, what is truly joyful and comforting to me can only be found after really hard work.
And time. I mean, with time it mellows into a much more profound joy than I could ever dream after only a little bit of experience of marriage. And I think that's important, you know, that we're so impatient. You know, we want you to come in and I want you to come and give me a seminar and tell me how I can have a completely rewarding marriage
mm-hmm.
tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have to be soberly realistic about how did God create human existence? What is it all about? How does it work? And it doesn't work by just finding a few key phrases that I can use in talking to my husband and he will love me forever. It doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
I need to do the right thing, and I need to consistently do the right thing, and I need to continue to do the right thing. And if he does the right thing as well in return, we can end up having a mature and healthy and whole marriage that is profoundly rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no shortcut to it.
So often I have people come into my office saying, you know, I just have this little problem, and I'd like you just to give me a few little answers. And I think it'll take us probably a session or two. And what they want is to know how to love. They want to know how to have a good relationship. They want to know, they want to change what's awful into something really good. And it's impossible. I can't give people a few easy, pithy statements that make it work. It won't. It would be me lying to them about it.
Yeah.
And it just, the commitment that it takes to have what's really good, to have what we really want deeply in our hearts is huge. It's a profoundly big commitment. But I think it's what life is all about.
Yeah. And as we've said in the past, even when we've got the best out of our marriage, it's still not going to be ultimately fulfilling. There's our heart is still going to long for even more. And until we have that perspective, we're always going to be disappointed. And we're never going to see life the way we need to see it.
Jack and Christine will be back in a couple of minutes to wrap up their discussion on the foundations of marriage. This program, Christianity at Work, is produced by the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. Mackenzie was established almost two decades ago as a place for people to come and seek answers to life's deepest questions. Two blocks from the University of Oregon campus, the ministry is able to focus on the most current needs of our culture, as well as the most basic issues of life. The staff of the Study Center believes that the message of the Bible is the most radical and most exciting message for the world today. As our world continues to turn away from God, they hope they can offer a meaningful defense for the gospel. The Mackenzie Study Center offers classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused towards seeking wisdom and pursuing righteousness in our everyday lives. The mainstay of the Study Center teaching ministry is the Tuesday night lectures. One of the classic in the series is Dr. Jack Crabtree's teaching, The Book of Romans. Other lecture and seminar topics include studies of the Book of Revelation, the Letter to the Hebrews, the Sovereignty of God, and a biblical perspective on the arts. The Study Center also has numerous articles which may help many in their growth as Christians. For example, in an article entitled Forgiveness, staff member Larry Barber and husband of Christine examines the difficulty of forgiveness in very hurtful situations and concludes that forgiveness does not necessarily mean forgetting. Rather, forgiveness means deciding not to retaliate against the person who has hurt you. All of the lectures and articles are available. Listen at the end of the program. We'll give you information how you can order tapes, articles, or even a copy of this program. Now again, here are Jack and Christine as they wrap up their discussion on the biblical foundations for marriage.
What really jumps out at me about what we said in this last hour is that I wanted my life to make me feel good. And specifically, I really wanted my marriage to make me feel good. I watched movies like Dr. Zhivago, Camelot, like you said, all the Disney movies, lots of movies, and lots of books, romance books, and they all were kind of happily ever after. They promised that I should have a man that would swoop me off my feet and make me feel good all the time. And I've really come to know and see that the vow that I made, that I didn't know I was making when I got married, was to commit myself to loving my husband even when it didn't feel good. That's a really difficult thing to do. It requires a lot of brokenness, a lot of humility. It's very difficult work that requires that I see myself as I am, and it requires that I really work at understanding and seeing my husband as he is.
And that's the thing that I think we need to emphasize, that the very essence and nature of marriage is a moral commitment, a responsibility, a moral obligation that I take on, that I require of myself to do right by my husband or wife. And
if I take on that moral commitment, that responsibility, what that leaves me with in the end is what I really truly long for the most. What it leaves me with is an outpouring of joy, an outpouring of openness and vulnerability and trust that is really quite fulfilling. It's really the best, I think, that's offered to us in life. But it only comes after we have gone through the process of really committing ourselves to loving another person.
And it's not the intoxicating love of infatuation. It's the more gentle and deeper and profound joy of connection, of deep connection with the other person.
Gentler, I want to say more substantive.
More substantive, yes.
Deeper.
Yeah. The reason the mythology of our culture is so attractive to us is that we would love to escape the human obligation to face hard choices, where I actually might have to choose against my own happiness and toward doing what I promised or doing what's good and right. We'd like to escape that. So the idea that I could put the two together and that I could be so in love with somebody that doing the good and right thing would be the same thing as doing what I want to do and following my desires is a really, really attractive fantasy and fiction. But it is just that. It is fiction. It is fantasy. Choosing to do the right thing and the good thing will always, in the end, be a hard choice. And marriage is a commitment to make a whole series of hard choices in life. And we just got to take that on.
That's what we've promised to do.
Exactly.
You've been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Next week, Jack and Christine will continue this discussion. In the meantime, if you'd like a copy of this program or would like to know more about McKenzie, please call us at area code 541-485-4801. Or you can write to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you can also find the study center on the web. If you didn't have time to write down the information just now, stay with us. We'll repeat it in just a bit. The study center's family of teachers and students invite you to join with them in their pursuit to understand the profound message of the Bible. The McKenzie Study Center staff is aware that their studies and dialogues stand in deep need of God's mercy. They hope their ministry and teaching will in some meaningful way be valuable to others. McKenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous support of people who have benefited from its ministry. Again, if you would like to know more about the Study Center, acquire its tapes, articles, or even have a copy of this program, please call us at area code 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Or write to McKenzie, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 1-800-273-9743. And if you are visiting Eugene, please come and see us. When ordering the program, ask for program number 2. Now, on behalf of the staff and community of the Study Center, thank you for listening.